Hello and welcome to another episode of Mere Fidelity, where we have conversations about life, theology, the church, and the culture. My name is Derek Rishmawi, and I'm joined by the full cast and crew, as well as a guest today. So we've got Matt Lee Anderson, Andrew Wilson, Alistair Roberts, and the irrepressible, unstoppable Pascal Emmanuel Gobry, also known as Peg, on as our Roman Catholic representative, because today we are taking up a special subject, which is Amoris Laetitia, the joy of love, Pope Francis's very long letter / book encyclical on the family that has caused quite a stir. Now, you might wonder why four Protestants want to talk to a Roman Catholic about Amoris Laetitia on their podcast. Well, the fact of the matter is, the Roman Catholic Church is the largest formal communion in the world, and the Pope as its head is still the largest, the well, not physically largest, but most prominent public Christian leader person who whether or not anybody wants him to speak for them, he does in some way. And so this letter means a lot, even for evangelicals around the world, or Protestants and so forth. So we just wanted to have Peg on, mostly as an excuse to have Peg on because he's fun. But yeah, so welcome on, Peg.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. This is a lot of fun. I enjoyed my last time. I hope I'm going to enjoy this one too.
We will see. We will see.
Right.
Wilson wasn't on, so. You know, things get dicey there. So we'll get to asking questions here. Peg, there's been a lot of controversy about this letter, and specifically a few paragraphs and a footnote concerning the issue of the divorce, remarriage, and communion issues, especially amongst conservatives. So would you mind kind of just broaching the subject for us, kind of explaining why conservatives are worried about what is in that section of the letter?
Right. So, the Catholic teaching is that once there's a valid marriage, that marriage is lifelong and only ends with the death of one of the spouses. If you get a civil divorce, the marriage continues, and so if you get remarried, that's adultery. And it's not just adultery, but it's a public commitment to adultery, and it's a public rebuke to the laws of the church. And so since we also believe that someone who is in a state of mortal sin, which means very grave, then cannot receive communion without a sacramental confession. The rule of the church has been that people who are civilly divorced and remarried cannot receive communion. This is a very controversial rule for many reasons. It was already controversial when Jesus promulgated it. In the Gospels, you know, there's this famous passage where he said, you know, the two shall be one flesh, and I think it was Peter, but I don't remember, one of the disciples tells him that in that case, you know, there's no point in even marrying. Why would anyone get married? So it's been and you know, there was that whole thing about the English Reformation, which you guys
heard
something about.
You Anglicans.
Right. And so, anyway,
so in a sense, this is a big thing. I mean, we've had splits in the church over this divorce and remarriage and communion issue. There's a whole wing of the church that would kind of be looking over their shoulders and saying, "Wait, so y'all were cool with that? Really? If that change were to happen?"
Right.
That's kind of what you're saying, yeah.
Right. I mean, there's you know, when you're talking about Catholic doctrine, there's always a sort of double debate, which is number one, about the doctrine itself, and then number two, about whether and how Catholic doctrine can change or develop or not, right? And so because, at least in theory, we believe that our tradition is unchanging and cannot change, at least in the essentials, certainly cannot contradict itself. This is the point that many of the conservatives have been making, which is that progressives who want to change the rules on communion don't so much want to change the rules on communion, but want to prove that the church can change its doctrine, and in particular its doctrine on areas around sex, right? Because that's once you've said, aha, well, the church can change its doctrine about sex, well, then you don't, you've basically opened the floodgates for, Catholic-flavored Episcopalianism.
Oh, man.
So can I ask?
Yeah, Matt, go for it.
It seems like one of the central thrusts of Francis's letter, Peg, is the relationship between general moral norms and particular situations.
Right.
So Francis seems to want to affirm the doctrinal norm that exists, to hold on to that sense of inviolability. But he really, he quotes Thomas's principle that as moral reasoning approaches particular situations, it gets more and more ambiguous. That this reflection about the specific moral situation is much harder to do. It's not quite as obvious as what you get in the general moral norm.
Right.
I guess one of the things that I wonder is there room? So the other thread of this is the way in which practice relates to doctrine,
right?
And the possibility of doctrinal changes happening because practice leads the way. So I was reading last night a book on Mary that was recapping some of the debates in Vatican II around Lumen Gentium. The statement on the church, where there was a big fight over what role Mary would give. It was the most disputed part, apparently, of Vatican II, and there were all sorts of Marian devotion practices around the world that were very robust. That side lost the war, and the story goes that within 10 years, practices had dried up. Essentially, Marian devotion was essentially gone. So there you had a doctrinal change, or at least shift in emphasis, that really had a substantive impact on the practices. Here, what you have are lots of practices that conservatives are worried are going to lead into a doctrinal change. I guess what I want to know is something like, between those two threads, is there any room at all for particular the kind of particular judgments about who could be admitted to communion? Is there any flexibility at all?
Right. I mean, as you may have guessed, I sort of side with the quote-unquote conservatives on the whole divorce, marriage, communion, change in tradition spectrum of issues. But where I would side with the supporters of Pope Francis is that he's absolutely correct on the merits, both on the merits and being in line with Catholic tradition, which is that, it is absolutely possible for me to imagine a situation, and I have seen it around me, of someone who quote-unquote objectively is in a quote-unquote irregular situation, but who I believe is fit for communion, either because they have perfect inward contrition or because they do not have knowledge of their sin. So if you take, for example, someone who has had a first Catholic marriage, who is remarried, but their first marriage was almost certainly invalid, but they haven't been able to get an annulment, well, they're not, objectively, there was a quote-unquote first marriage, but actually, I would say that that person, if they believe in their conscience that, honestly, that their first marriage was not valid and that they need the sacrament, that person can go to communion. And I personally advise people who are in those, in quote-unquote irregular situations, to go and receive communion. And where Francis is absolutely right is that there's always a job of discernment in how you apply the rules to your particular life, and there's always a primacy of conscience. And, you know, Aquinas said it's better to die as a heretic and follow your conscience than to stay in the church and violate your conscience. So that's always been part of Catholic teaching. And in that sense, you know, Francis is sort of, is not reiterating, but is making clear, putting out in the open something that is, that's always been around. What people fear, I think there's two things. Number one, there's a lack of clarity around what the rule is, because, you know, all of the headlines have been, you know, Pope Francis opens the door to da da da. And second of all, this sort of domino effect where, you know, because we're in this sort of trench warfare around sexual issues, if you give an inch to anything, then all of a sudden 20 years down the line, you know, we're having gay weddings in St. Peter's Square.
Yeah, and the rejoinder to that last part is something like, but if you never give an inch because sort of come around to the right position, then you're going to unintentionally lose people anyways, because your position won't have the kind of appeal that in fact it needs to over the long term. So can I ask, though, on the situation that you described, the originally valid marriage, isn't it the case that to be a valid sacramental marriage, it has to be more than getting married within a Catholic church by a Catholic priest? Don't you have to have a full, like, subjective intention, understanding of what the sacramental dimension is and will that sacramental side? So
isn't it possible?
Yeah, so that's why the argument, you know, people talk about how there's an anthropological pessimism and a lack of belief in grace. So when somebody, I think it was Casper, said that probably 50% of Catholic wed marriages,
that's what I was gonna
marriages
ask.
Are probably invalid. On the merits, I think that's correct. I mean, I actually there was a priest who was, you know, in his 70s and had seen a lot of things, and said, you know, if you look deep down, probably most Catholic marriages are not invalid. Like, you know, you know, I saw a lot of people, you know, fall down from their chairs when they saw Casper say this and think, how could he say such a thing? But if you talk to enough priests who have been around, you're not going to be surprised by that.
But it seemed like, in the conservative response, Ross Douthat, whom I love and adore, you know, he had a post on all this responding to Alan Jacobs, basically saying that he does. But one of the things that Ross said, it seemed like, was that part of the conservative worry is that this change will introduce degrees of validity into. But it actually seems like there are degrees of validity already in place in Catholic doctrine. If you, like, there is a kind of imperfect participation in marriage if you don't have the full, and it seems like this opening of communion for those who have been remarried hinges upon that, and hinges upon discerning when people had imperfect participation in otherwise imperfect subjective participation in otherwise sacramental marriages, and when they had full appropriate participation And there's, I don't see any other way of determining that other than by priests on the ground talking with them, sorting out, doing casuistry of the sort of old school sort.
Exactly. And I mean, the conservative response would be to say, yes, what you're saying is correct. I mean, not the conservative response, but the sort of Francis critique, critique of Francis response would be to say, yeah, that's right. But in that whole process, the Pope's job is to set out the sort of, you know, high principles as clearly as possible, with the understanding that then on the ground how you apply those principles is up to pastors and individual consciences. And the Pope is actually making it harder by making everybody just more confused about what the rule is, and therefore how do you even think about applying it. And I'm not sure what I think of that argument. I would say that it's the Pope's job to teach, and that how each individual Pope does it is according to his own, you know, vocation and charisms and so on. I still remain a sort of moderate fan of Francis.
Moderate as in you're somewhat of a fan, not you've become a moderate.
Right. I wouldn't describe myself as a moderate. I'm moderately a fan. I'm not.
Yeah.
There's certainly nothing moderate about my Catholicism.
Oh, we know, Peg. Oh, we know. That's why we like you.
I'm wondering, Andrew or Alistair, do you have any questions for our illustrious guest?
Matthew Schmitz has an interesting article in First Things called Always Fear, Always Love. And he talks about one of the things that statements that Pope Francis makes is love abhors making others suffer. Courtesy is a school of sensitivity and disinterestedness, which requires a person to develop his or her mind and feelings, learning how to listen, how to speak, and at certain times to keep quiet. It is not something a Christian may accept or reject. As an essential requirement of love, every human being is bound to live agreeably with those around him. One of the things that Pope Francis is often praised for is his pastoral approach to these sorts of issues. I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on, first of all, what does it mean to take a pastoral approach? Because often I think what we see in Scripture is pastoral leadership is very much about strength of nerve facing difficult right. moral questions for the sake of everyone else so that they don't have to wrestle with these on the front line. But then there's also that aspect of sensitivity and recognizing the complexity of particular situations and being sensitive and capitulating through that sensitivity is not necessarily the same thing as seeing the complexity of a situation where there's been
right.
a wholesale collapse of our marriage culture and trying to pick up the pieces.
Right. How to be a bishop if I knew, you know, it's the worst job in the world. I mean, it's the most thankless job in the world. And I am fully convinced that there are entire squads of demons whose job is specifically dedicated to tempting and harassing bishops spiritually. So how do you, that's the tension. You have to set out clear moral rules, and there are times for, you can pick your example. Saint Ambrose, you know, kicking the Roman emperor out of his church and so forth. At the same time, people need, number one, there are very complicated personal situations which don't fall into the rules neatly. And number two, I don't know if it's a quote-unquote modern thing or whatever, but people need to feel understood and loved before they will listen to you. And so, reiterating a moral rule is pointless if if the person isn't going to listen to it. I have no idea if this is a good answer or not, but there,
that's just the problem of pastoral work.
I have such tremendous admiration and respect for those who do it well, and I have no idea how I would go about doing it. And apart from the fact that I wouldn't have to deal with a spouse or children, I'm so thankful that I don't have to be a priest.
Can I ask something? This is this may be a slight change of tack. This is just such a fascinating dimension to me that the Conservatives. I think you even just used the phrase a few minutes ago. I'm a conservative. Generally, I'm a conservative, and therefore, as opposed to being on siding with Pope Francis. You said something like that, and obviously that's been true of the guys I've read online, of a number of them. And I just, as an idiot Protestant who doesn't has never been Catholic and doesn't have a huge amount of context for processing, obviously until I started reading Ross's column, I didn't really understand that you could be both of those things. I would have assumed that a conservative position was a very, very high view of not just papal authority but papal accuracy and care and consideration and, you know, nuance and that sort of thing. So I guess I'm trying to think, how does that circle get squared internally for somebody in your kind of position? Is it through a sharp distinction between ex cathedra statements and papal letters? Is it what's the process that goes on internally saying I'm a conservative Catholic and I disagree with the Pope on it? Because that's not something that for me, and I imagine for some people, not the easiest thing to be able to see how you do that, in the sense that that would be a little bit like me sort of saying, I think Peter or Paul or James or whoever was wrong about it. So how does that work? And I ask that in a sort of very genuine way. What process do you go through?
Right. It's not, you don't have to. So first of all, I don't think that I don't intensely dislike this letter or this Pope. To the contrary, I still like the Pope, and I think that what the letter actually says is correct. So I don't have any sort of real dilemma, as in, if the Pope, woke up tomorrow and said, I infallibly proclaim that God doesn't have three persons, it's just a monist God, then I would have a real problem. But since he's not going to do that, the way it's traditionally understood is that you have to give complete assent of faith and will to everything that is infallible about the Church's doctrine, meaning the teaching of sacred scripture and tradition, which includes papal teachings. And then for everything else, there are degrees of how obliged you are to agree with them. And the way I sort of explain this to other people, because believe me, Catholics struggle with this as well, I like to say that it's like when your best friend tells you something. When your best friend, or when your mentor, the person whose experience and wisdom you respect the most, tells you something that they think is really important for you to hear, you might still not agree with it in the end, and you're not going to say, well, I have a duty to agree to it, but you're not going to reject it out of hand. You're not going to just airily dismiss it. You're going to struggle through it. And that's how I deal with sort of non-authoritative forms of papal teachings, which this letter is.
That's really helpful. Actually, that's a very clarifying analogy.
Right.
So, I'm imagining that Matt already has another question.
Matt. Throwing it on me, I appreciate that. Well, I actually don't. That is the amazing part. Peg, here's one thing that I'd like to hear your take on. How should Protestants think about this?
And I realize that it
They should. I know
what you're going to say.
You really just opened the door on that, Matt.
That's basically how they go about it. All right, I guess we're done here now.
I'm not letting go of this phone until we're all on the road together. Oh, man.
I'm so glad that we'll be here forever. I have nothing else in my life to do. So it seems like a central aspect of Francis's papal ministry has been to allow for ecumenical dialogue. We're on the cusp of the, is it the 500th anniversary of the
500
of the Reformation?
Yeah.
And one thing that intrigues me about all of this is that Ratzinger, Benedict 16, I've always thought that if anyone was well positioned within the Catholic Church to lead them, you all, through the anniversary of the Reformation, it was Benedict. Benedict, the enormously theologically sophisticated thinker who trained with a bunch of German Lutheran theologians and knew just how rich the Protestant world of...
He wrote some very nice things about Luther.
Yeah, I mean, Ratzinger is great, which is why I often will tell Catholic people who try to proselytize me that as soon as they can speak about Protestants the way that Benedict did, then we can talk.
I'm not there yet.
Yeah, I know. Oh, I know. Francis is coming at this from a very different angle, right? He's aware of the depths of Protestant piety, and specifically evangelical and charismatic Protestant piety within the developing world, and he's aware of the renewal and the gifts that Protestants have brought to Christianity writ large. Do you think that ecumenical overtures are lurking in the background of this push? Do you think that it's an attempt to sow seeds for expanded dialogue? Because
it's an argument from the progressive camp that this removes. And it's always been fascinating to me how many Protestants care about this debate, because it's a completely Catholic debate. Like, your rules about marriage are
biblical.
I don't know how I would describe them. No, that's not the word I would use. And neither are rules about, they're completely different. Stupid jokes or polemics. It's different. It's different rules about marriage.
Yeah, it's a different logic.
Rules about communion, and it's a different logic, exactly. So it was fascinating to see. Like, I think parts of it was concern trolling, but which is fine, which is fair enough.
That was me.
Well, you're raising a very interesting point here, because this is the thing that evangelicals have been curious about is on the one hand, most of them don't actually agree with the Roman Catholic Church's view on divorce and remarriage, right? But the conservatives are concerned that if the Roman Catholic Church buckles on the logic of changing their doctrine on these issues.
Right. It's almost like, well, you're torn between.
Yeah, you're torn between, like, okay, well, there's something valuable about good Catholics being good Catholics. Like, I respect that. Like, you know, Peg, you're a Catholic troll, and, you know, we go back and forth. But the point is, you're a Catholic troll, and I get, you know, I know what I'm getting here, and you are consistent about it. And that consistency of like the pattern of authority and logic involved, there's a similarity in terms of the way, you know, a scripture, you know, a Protestant will think about the authority of scripture and the way it can be changed, et cetera, et cetera. But at the same time, you're like, but materially, what we disagree on that issue. And so you're kind of torn between, do you want them to agree on that issue, or do you want them to be a good Catholic? It's just so that's been one of those interesting tensions that I've seen evangelicals navigating.
I agree. One of my sort of unpopular views is that, you know, the main issue separating Catholicism and everything else isn't, you know, papal authority with the Orthodox or justification by faith or sola scriptura with the Protestants. It's, you know, it's marriage and contraception. You know, because, you know, like, you know, let's say that, you know, 20 years from now at Nicaea or whatever the village is now called in Turkey, you have a bunch of Catholic bishops and a bunch of Orthodox bishops who agree to something about, you know, like the Nicene Creed or whatever. You're going to have families in Romania that are going to be told, wait a second, now my second marriage isn't a second marriage, and now I can't use contraception anymore. And they're going to go, and they're going to start their alternative churches, which will take at least half of the people, and which means the bishops won't come in the first place, because what's the point of formally reuniting the churches if everybody leaves the new united church? And, you know, not to troll or anything, but
because you'd never do that. God forbid.
I never do that.
Hard to separate your serious comments from your. So we appreciate the warning.
Right. I think you guys are fans as well as I am of Russell Moore. And he did a conference a few years back about, you know, sex issues and whatever, and there were a bunch of panels, and I was watching on the internet while doing something else. And there was a panel about, you know, marriage culture and the sexual revolution. And somebody was saying, well, since the 60s, you know, things have gone downhill and so on and so forth. And, you know, somebody sort of innocently asked, you know, well, what happened in the 60s? And people were like, well, it was TV, it was culture. And I was sitting on my desk screaming, it's the pill. And it was a great event. I loved everything that was said, but it lasted for an entire day. Nobody even once said the word pill or contraception, even though it's the absolute center of the sexual revolution. It's what caused everything else, right? Without the pill, you don't have casual sex culture. Without the pill, you don't have this sort of, you know, contractual view of marriage, which is just about the two adults and not about procreation, therefore not about building something bigger than just, you know, your romantic connection with the other person and so on and so forth. And, you know, I love my Southern Baptist friends, but, you know, like, I've never met Moore, but I bet that if I were to talk to him personally, he would totally agree with me on the merits, but he's never going to say it publicly because he knows that all of his flock is on the pill.
As are all the American Catholics too. Let's be clear.
By the way, do American Catholics?
I'm not judging anybody. And but, you know, the simple fact of the
matter is
the way our tradition is set up means that we can't, you know, we can't pretend that the teaching isn't there.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
Like everybody in the Catholic Church is on the pill as well, just like everybody, you know, lies, cheats, and steals. But, you know, nobody, you know, it's just not contemplated within any major Protestant denomination to say, hey, to even have some sort of official statement which says, hey, maybe the pill isn't a good idea, which, by the way, this new papal document that everybody is hailing as a victory for progressives does say, right? He does explicitly reaffirm the condemnation of contraceptive culture and so on.
Right.
Yeah.
And everybody, you have this document that is called the victory for progressive, which is quote unquote way more conservative in places than anything you can even imagine coming out of the Southern Baptist Convention. Not to pick on them. I'm not saying, you know, you dirty Protestants are on the pill and we Catholics are all having 8 kids. That's obviously not the case. But the point is that this is like a huge sticking point. And I think if we're talking about ecumenical dialogue in practice, it would be a much bigger sticking point than justification by faith or whatever.
That's actually something I wanted to ask you about, because we've talked a lot about a few small sections of this document, but much of it is concerned with laying out certain aspects of the teaching of marriage of the church in a very positive and in a way that is directed to people in congregations and in marriages trying to understand their own marriage and how to make them work. And so there's sections about how the family relates to the Trinity as its image in certain ways. There's other passages that talk about the role of the father, the role of the mother, and the way that these things are challenged within contemporary society. There are passages that speak about same-sex unions. There are passages that speak about what love means, all these sorts of things. Could you briefly give us a sense of the other things that this document says that we can gain from?
Right, right. That's an excellent point. I mean, it's 200 pages, and we're sort of quote unquote forced to focus on the sort of hot button political stuff. The first chapter is biblical exegesis on the theme of the family in the Bible, which is just great. I mean, it's stuff we already know. It's about Genesis. It's about the Psalms. It's about the image of the church as the bride of Christ, and, you know, the heavenly banquet of Revelation, all that stuff. But it's still very beautiful and very moving. As you point out, it points out that the family is a sort of icon of the Trinity, which I think is a very beautiful and very important teaching. That's really, you know, you have the complementarity of love, which ends up being fruitful and creative. That's the image. And there you go, contraception again. Anyway, so there's that. And there's one of the things that's been noted is that there's a lot of practical advice. It's almost like a self-help book in parts. And I think that's a very good thing, because I think that, frankly, people need less theology and less biblical exegesis and more concrete help on how to live their lives and how to reach those goals. Because a lot of people, give up because they don't think they just believe they're impossible, and a lot of people want to give it a shot but don't know how. It's one of the cliches of this papacy that he's the more pastoral pope, whereas John Paul II and Benedict XVI were, you know, academics. And I absolutely adore and admire both John Paul II and Benedict XVI, but I really like this aspect of the papacy. And, you know, the papacy is not it's a teaching office, but it's not an academic office. It's a prophetic office. If academic expertise was a requirement of the papacy, the Pope would have been Paul, not Peter. And so I think that's a great aspect of this papacy, and it's what drives many conservatives nuts, but it's actually something that I really like, because I think it's really important, especially nowadays. I don't know if I've answered your question.
No, that's very helpful.
Fellas, do we feel enlightened? Do we feel the joy of love?
Goodness, goodness.
Do you feel a need to say a Hail Mary?
I feel enlightened, and I feel the joy of love.
Hail Mary's thrown.
I feel like I've got exactly the right balance.
I think we Brits are a bit more reserved about this sort of thing. There was a thing in the paper earlier today that was talking about part of the campaign to keep Britain in Europe and recommending that Europeans hug a Brit. And yes, that would backfire terribly.
Hug Brits.
Hug a Brit.
Oh, man. One of the first things I do, Alistair, when we finally meet on some shore, I will give you a bear hug. And that might end our friendship, but I hope not. All right. Well, hey, Peg, this has been a great show. Thanks for coming on. Thanks for dealing with our ignorant Protestant questions. But that's, I guess, some of the.
I managed to do an angry rant about contraception.
There you go.
It's always a good use of time.
You know, my,
but that's
that,
not that
that,
different
that's
from
my
Matt.
Goal for every
so,
day, so you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Excellent. Well, hey, thanks for coming on.
Every day
on.
I gotta find some excuse to get angry about contraception, so it's really hard. No, actually, it's very easy. It's very easy.
It's very easy. Oh, man. Well, hey, if you listened in, thank you. Please share this with your friends and neighbors if you found it helpful. Also, feel free to rate and review the show on iTunes. That always helps. And we will have a link to our Patreon account at mereorthodoxy.com. But for now, again, thanks for listening. Catch you next episode.